Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The blood is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger, unafraid, right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. 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 Radio.
I think of you as an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out of here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
We're a bunch of a-holes.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention?
Ejector systems are offline.
Mario!
We'll do it live! Do it live! I can all write it and we'll do it live!
What the hell's going on out here? Ladies and gentlemen,
here it is. Because
there's no one like you left.
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough. 503 Central, 603 East Coast, 403 Mountain, 303 West Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Tuesday morning, Sydney, Australia. 803, you are probably already late. Welcome to the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio, revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite browser, regardless of the platform that you use, gets you to us, our award-winning, 100% listener-supported, internet, 800,000-watt blowtorch. 48 of you fine folks in the chat room this evening. Apparently, somebody believes we need a Negro genocide. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I will not mention the name to prevent harm to the mischaracterized message in the chat room. To Brandy Lou, Caveman, Captain Kirk. Captain, your dog is missing. I'm sorry. I don't know if it has anything to do with David Paletus or wormholes, but we'll find out. Mitzi, Tony, Batsman, Fleisch, Hemp, period. Dude Guy, Walther, SJ number one, Riker, hello, Lady Horse, hello. Tootsie, Christine C, I caught your program. Very good. Good evening, ma'am. 3D, The Sherbinator. I believe that's taken from the American Pie movies. Surrey Sunflower, hello, ma'am. Malia. Nisomania, Lauren, Rudolph, Comet, Dirt Engineer number two, Mona, hello, boy, Monster 383, which equals 14. That is still math, kids. Dry Fly Guy, Cat Dog Girl, not much to it. Patty, my favorite radio host, Mr. Rowe. Common Man, Pac Woman, I'm sorry. May Street 139, Pleasant Pheasant Plucker 2. Ladies and gentlemen, we may have a strong contender for my favorite chat name. Let me read that again. Pleasant Pheasant Plucker 2. Choppy Water, Doctor Who, a Mad, Jerbear, your friends are here, Wally, Valerie, in the kitchen, my favorite chatter, I'm sorry, Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III, Stardust Man, Omega Logos, and still, my number one favorite chat name, Popsicle Toes, but listen, Pops, Pleasant Pheasant Plucker 2 is challenging you for that spot. I would love you, someone, to say Pleasant Pheasant Plucker 2 5 times quickly. You've got to be careful. You have to be careful. I can't talk. Careful. Yes, Captain Kirk, I am sorry that your dog is missing today. All right. No news on my end. The zombie apocalypse has yet occurred. Not occurred. I'm still waiting, but, you know, time will tell. All right. Let's get into it. News from around... I got something in my eye. I'm sorry. News from around. Hang on. You ever get an eyelash in your eye and then your eyelash just starts flickering? That's what just happened. Chicago weekend of gun violence. 11 killed, 35 wounded. Go-Go Joe 2020 was there a number of days ago. It was last week. And went to a suburb, not the dreaded south crime-ridden area of Chi-Town. At least 46 were shot, 11 fatally across Chicago over the weekend. Copyright the Chicago Sun-Times. Dated today, July 12, 2021, 6:15 a.m. Central Daylight Time this morning. A man was killed and another wounded Friday evening in his home in West Pullman on the far south side. The shooting occurred around 5:20 p.m. on the 11,800 block of South State Street. Chicago police said Sean Young, 47, was shot in the head, buttocks, and was pronounced dead at the scene. I presuming that perhaps Sean was running away and two shots were fired. Not quite sure the order they hit, but when you aim for the head, you're aiming for someone to die. The other man, 34-year-old, was struck in the hand and shoulder. He was in critical condition at Christ Medical Center in Oaklawn. About an hour later, a man was killed in Roseland on the south side. He was on the sidewalk in the 11,000 block of South Vernon Avenue when a light-colored vehicle pulled up and someone inside fired about 6:20 p.m., police said. The 39-year-old was struck in the chest and taken to University of Chicago Medical Center. He was pronounced dead, police said. His name has not been released. So there you go, kiddies. Just, you know, good old drive-bys in Chicago. The no-go gun zone, just so you know. Two people were shot and killed on Saturday. Man was killed and two women were wounded Saturday night outside Cook County Jail. On Sunday, a man was killed, another critically wounded. Then there's a whole list of non-fatal attacks from the city that never sleeps. Which is interesting. Now, I'm going to post something in the chat room here. If you don't believe the data I am providing you, you can go to this website, compliments of the Sun-Times, and you can basically pop in great data. You can look at the past 12 months, the cause of shooting, either stabbing or shooting. We're going to look at shooting. The race slash ethnicity, unknown, black, white, Hispanic, other, Asian, American, Indian. You can select male or female. Oh, just for fun. Let's take a look at the number of black men who were shot in Chicago in the past 12 months between the ages of 0 and 121. 506. Compare that with black women, 53. Let's look at shooting deaths of non-black folks. Oh, 39 white men were shot compared to 3 white women. There's a lot of Asian hate going on, I believe, in Chicago. Let's find that out. Oh, there's not Asian hate in Chicago. You know how I know this? Because in the last 12 months, only 2 Asian men have been shot in Chicago. compared to zero Asian females. So apparently, Asian hate does not rear its ugly head in the city of Chicago. Allegedly. Allegedly. Here's something interesting. The body of an 18-year-old woman pulled from Chicago River near Goose Island. Wait a minute. When I pulled this story up, I purposely thought to myself, we have not had a smiley face killer update in, as the kids say on the street, a minute. I got no clue what that means. I think it just means in a while, but for some reason, saying language such as a minute or a hot minute makes you cool. I think it just makes you stupid, but that's me. An 18-year-old woman was pronounced... I'm going to write some notes down here, kids. Why? Because I believe this may, in fact, be a missing 411 case or a smiley face killer case. I'm not quite sure. Let's get going, Captain Fred. Female, 18, pronounced dead after her body was pulled from the Chicago River Sunday morning near Goose Island on the north side. Oh my gosh. Emergency crews were called to the scene of a person in the water about 10:15 a.m. near the 1100 block of North Cherry Avenue, according to Chicago police and fire officials. The incident was then determined to be a body recovery, handled by Chicago police and fire officials said. The CPD Marine unit pulled an unresponsive 18-year-old woman from the river. She was pronounced dead, according to police. Area 5 and Area 3 detectives are investigating the incident. This is a developing story. Please check back for details. Wait a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, have I just received the scoop? This was dated yesterday. Have I just scooped David Politis? Have I found a smiley face killer / missing 411 victim? Female 18. Found in water, as David Politis would say. Let's wait for the coroner's report. I'm not saying this is a 411 case, but something is suspicious about it. Mind you, I've read nothing suspicious. Not making fun, but it's quite sad. Speaking of the smiley face killer, you do know, folks, that there has technically only been one legitimate smiley face killer in the history of serial killers. Born in 1955, Keith Hunter Jesperson, the award winner who brutally murdered 8 women between 1990 and 1995, committed his first murder in 1990. These victims, who were often raped and strangled, including short-term acquaintances, sex workers, and a girlfriend, he left bodies not only across the Pacific Northwest, California, Oregon, but also Florida, Nebraska, the Midwest, and Washington State, while working as, you guessed it, a long-haul truck driver. Now, I will give a little bit of credit to the smiley face killer duo of Gannon Duarte in Gilbertson, because they hypothesized that the smiley face killer was in fact a long road, long haul CDL carrying truck driver. Now, whether or not they knew anything about Keith Hunter Jesperson, I have no idea. In the Forensic Drowning Brook book, I see no mention of him. In the discussion I had with William Ramsey regarding the smiley face killer, that happened, a couple years ago here on this very program. I don't recall he ever mentioning Keith Hunter Jesperson. Nowhere in the 6-part Oxygen Channel series, Smiley Case Killer Hunt for Justice, was Keith Hunter Jesperson mentioned. Before Jesperson was identified as a serial killer, he anonymously confessed to his crimes in messages that contained, you guessed it, smiley faces, which led to the nickname the Happy Face Killer. In addition to murder, Jesperson's criminal history included animal cruelty, arson, and sexual assault. So, the smiley face slash happy face serial killer, Keith Hunter Jesperson, still incarcerated, not dead. And that got me thinking about a horrible program documentary on one of your pay-per channels titled Smiley Face Killers. I literally turned it on and watched maybe 40 seconds of it because it begins where the movie posits that more than 150 there have been more than 150 deaths of college age men since 1977. And the deaths have not been disputed. Or the number has been disputed. The cause of death has been disputed. I misspoke. Now look at although I watched the first few minutes and then turned it off, I had to regain my composure and challenge myself again. And let me tell you this. This movie was B as in B, S as in S, and a complete waste of my time. I will never get that time back again. Shame. Who was the director of, I forget the director of this movie, the writer, producer, the director, what have you. But it's just horrible. It focuses a bit on this California college kid, Jake, I think his name is. And like most college kids, right, he's got some problems. He's got some boring personal problems. You know, he's anxious, a lot of angst going on, which probably related to the decision for him to stop taking his medication for what the show defines as, you know, mental health issues. And the movie poorly defined it, so I don't know what that meant. In the documentary film, whatever it's called, there's a lot of talk about Jake's meds, and whether he was on them or off them. Jake had a soccer friend or a teammate by the name of Adam. Jake had a girlfriend, Karen. Naturally, they talked about how they both were concerned about him. Although they equally want to know if he can obtain for each of them, you know, some ecstasy for a party that they're attending. So there's some drama in there about ex-boyfriends. So you kind of see, I pinned this out as quickly as I could. I mean, early on, you've got a college-age kid, right? He's got some quote-unquote problems. Maybe he's self-medicating. Maybe he isn't. He's got a best friend who's concerned about him as well as his girlfriend. But then perhaps there's some hanky-panky going on between his current girlfriend and the fact that she's hung up on her ex-boyfriend. Right, he becomes paranoid and jealous, but he's also procuring for these two people some ecstasy for a party, you know, the sex drug or what have you. So it's just a horrible show. It's just a horrible show. It's easy to forget. It's bad. There's at some point where, you know, the killers keep sending Jake text messages apparently through the dark web. That's how they obtained his number or something. These messages read, "I think the water wants you," linking the assumption that all the smiley face killer purposely dumps bodies into the river. You're just gonna add a little politis in there, so it's very bad. So look, my point is this: you want to watch a really bad show? Get some popcorn about the smiley face killers. Literally, go to one of the three major pay-for-services type streaming shows, Amazon, Netflix, or Hulu. Type in Smiley Face Killers, and you'll find this. Look, it's bad. It basically takes every ridiculous part about the, at best, research hypothesis that Gannon, Duarte, and Gilbertson are attempting to push and go put on crack and literally makes it ridiculous. And I'm now a dumber person for having to watch this whole entire thing. I forgot to mention to you folks last week, the week before, and I can't believe I missed it, that back on the week of second week of June, was it the second week of June? Let me make sure I got my dates right. No, the third week of June was the 40th anniversary of the Atlanta child murders, when Wayne Bertram Williams, June 21, 1981, was apprehended. The 23-year-old man was apprehended and has spent the last 40 years in jail for technically, the murders of two adults, sentenced to two life terms in prison with the possibility of parole. But then they have long suspected that he had murdered more than 20 of Atlanta's metro children between 79 and 81, known as the Atlanta child murders. Wayne Williams, who now is 63, his last parole was denied back in 2019. He will be eligible for parole once again, I believe, in 2027. Is that right? Yes, November of 2027, he will be eligible for parole, which is the maximum date of 8 years. He needs to be reviewed for parole every 8 years. According to Fox 5, and this story dated back in December, Rick Jacobs, director of Clemency and Parole Selection Division, wrote, quote, "You are encouraged to continue in your rehabilitative efforts, so you will be properly prepared to succeed in the event a future consideration results in your transition back into society," end quote. And that was the response based on the board that sent Williams' letter, stating that there was an insufficient amount of time served to date given the nature and circumstances of your offenses. I believe Wayne will never be released just because it's too painful for the city of Atlanta. Now, there was some big hoopla, right, back in 2019, where Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms said, "We've got some DNA. We're going to open this up. We're going to test it and what have you." This story came out last month, and I missed it, but new DNA testing in Atlanta child murders on hold for unexplained funding issues. "The investigation remains open, and we are awaiting approval for funding to cover the DNA testing of our evidence in the case," said Officer Steve Avery, an Atlanta Police Department spokesperson, in an email, quote, "Once the funding is approved, we will submit the evidence to the crime lab and move forward with testing. We do not have a timeline at the moment, but are hopeful we will be moving forward with this soon," end quote. I thought they had funding all wrapped up for this, but apparently they do not. None whatsoever. So all the parents that are still alive trying to find out answers to whether or not Wayne Williams murdered their child or had any, any part in it, those questions will never get answered. And that's the saddest part of the whole thing, right? The fact that they will never know. That they will simply never know what happened. That is actually pretty sad. It is unfortunate. We will do Politis on Thursday, I think, maybe. But there is a missing person that I have not yet seen Politis mention. Dated July 10th, 2021. U.S. officials are searching for missing Dublin man Cian McLaughlin, have issued an update flyer providing more information on the items he had in his possession when he set off for his hike last month. The search for Cian McLaughlin who was last seen in Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming on June 8th, is continuing, but on scaled back basis. Concerns were raised when he didn't arrive at work 2 days later, and he was subsequently reported missing to Teton County Sheriff's Office. Officials said an update overnight that no new information has been reported about the missing 27-year-old, but more details have been revealed about what he had with him when he disappeared. These include a red Apple Watch, a red iPhone 12 mini, a white short sleeve t-shirt, and wired rimmed sunglasses. While he is also believed to have been wearing a hat, shorts, and hiking boots. A statement from the National Park said, quote, no new information has been reported about missing 27-year-old hiker Cian McClellan. The park continues to request any information the public may have in aiding to locate McClellan. Now, he was last seen in the late afternoon evening on Tuesday, June the 8th, 2021, on the south side of Bradley Taggart Moraine, headed south towards Taggart Lake. Well, I'm surprised Pletus is not all over this, because it has two things in common so far. Well, a number. 27-year-old, apparently experienced hiker, in proximity to water. So, not quite sure. A Wyoming resident has come forward after returning from an overseas trip to say they saw Mr. McClellan in the late or early afternoon on June 8th, which is later than the previous last known sightings of the same day. Now, the individual contacted authorities to reveal he had a conversation with Mr. McClellan on the south side of Bradley Taggart Moraine in Grand Teton National Park. The individual reported McClellan was headed south towards Taggart Lake and had a conversation with McClellan where he described where he worked, that he's from Ireland and currently living in Jackson. So apparently there is some misinformation floating around, or some people's timelines are not quite up to par. Now, I know that people who subscribe to the David Politis ilk always talk about how the National Park Service never keeps records of anything. Well, I will put for all of you fine folks, once again in the chat room, how the National Park does. It keeps not only cold cases on numerous people. James Pruitt, I believe. Politis covered him. Jiangyan Wan, missing since 2017. Peter Jackson, Floyd E. Roberts III. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. They also have updates. For instance, you may not hear David Politis discuss how the National Park Service, seeking tips from the public to aid a homicide investigation in Hot Springs National Park. Now, this is all the way back from the 13th, which still has not been solved. Special agents of the National Park Service Investigative Services branches are seeking tips from the public to determine the circumstances related to the homicide of Paige Autumn White, a 32-year-old Caucasian female with a missing right eye and an anchor tattoo on her right foot. White's remains were found off the Black Snake Road in Hot Springs National Park on March 27, 2021. The investigation is ongoing, and there's no indication that this was other than an isolated incident, because there were some folks on social media who were talking about how there was a serial killer running around the National Forest killing people. I believe that was fake news and misinformation. So we'll get into these exciting things and more come Thursday when we dive into David Politis and missing 411 and all that happenstance. So stick around for that. And with that said, folks, let's visit our friends this week once again over at Bedtime Stories for your listening pleasure on this Monday evening.
In December of 2000, an entire family was murdered inside their home address in Western Tokyo. Despite leaving numerous clues behind at the crime scene, the killer has never been identified, with the police investigation continuing to this day. This week, in December of 2000,
we look into the harrowing case of the Setagaya murders. Staring at the crime scene photos which had been laid out on the desk of his dimly lit office, Takeshi Tsuchida felt consumed by an overwhelming sense of frustration. It had been over a week since the elderly lady had discovered the bodies of her family, brutally slaughtered in their own home, and the police investigation thus far still had yet to identify a suspect for the crime. As chief officer of the Seijo police station, Tsuchida had inevitably been entrusted with this high-profile case, along with orders to bring the matter to a quick resolution. And at first glance, that had seemed a foregone conclusion, with personal belongings and forensic evidence left behind by the offender yielding vital clues, which should have irrefutably uncovered the killer's identity. But within a short space of time, it had become apparent that the DNA which had been recovered from the crime scene did not relate to any held in the national database, effectively curtailing what should have been the most obvious and effective line of inquiry. In the absence of this, his investigators had quite naturally fallen back on witness and surveillance evidence, only to come to the realization that there was frustratingly little to go on. The killer had not been captured on any of the CCTV cameras which surrounded the premises, and what little witness testimony had been uncovered thus far had proven sorely lacking in any useful detail. Gathering the photographs together and returning them to the case file, he glanced across at the sheet of A4 paper he had intended to use to map out the next stages of the investigation. Apart from going further afield, beyond Japan's borders, to inquire if the DNA evidence matched any records held in neighbouring countries, the page remained dauntingly empty. A career investigator, Tsuchida had encountered few cases during his service which had affected him as much as this, given the sheer brutality and horror the attending officers had documented at the scene. And despite their best efforts to keep the specific details of the murders from escaping into the public domain, the department's reputation was already under sustained attack. Whilst updating his superiors on the progress of the case, he had noted the concerned glances and weary sighs his remarks had elicited. He'd also been asked to comment on several newspaper articles, accusing his men of incompetency and inefficiency, citing largely historical issues within the Tokyo Metropolitan Police, which had long since been resolved. Taking up his pen, he stared again at the empty page before him, silently determined that he would find and punish this brutal killer. No matter what the cost or personal sacrifice, no barrier would stand in his way as he worked to identify the man who had savagely robbed four innocent family members of their lives. It did not take long for the investigators assigned to the Setagaya killings to piece together a timeline regarding the final hours of the victims, who had spent the 30th of December like so many other families in Tokyo that day, preparing to see out the end of the year together. During the course of their day, they had gone out shopping before returning home and making arrangements for the following day's celebrations with relatives over the phone. After dinner, they had then spent the evening watching television, before finally retiring to bed. The head of the household, 44-year-old Mikio Miyazawa, worked for a marketing company and had periodically logged onto his computer throughout the course of the day to check for and reply to work-related emails. Whilst he did this, his wife, Yasuko, had entertained their two children, 8-year-old Nina and her little brother Ray. But as the four of them had later been sound asleep in their beds, at approximately 11:30 p.m., a dark figure had slowly emerged from the interior of the park which bordered the rear of their home. This shadowy form had silently slipped from a group of trees, before cautiously scaling another tree which stood in the garden of the address. He had then reached across and removed a protective screen which covered the second floor bathroom window, before hauling himself in through the now insecure opening. Once inside, the offender had walked into the nearest bedroom where 6-year-old Ray was asleep, before strangling the boy to death with his bare hands. This horrendous act must have caused some level of disturbance, as it immediately brought Mikio running upstairs from the first floor, where he had been sleeping. The struggle that took place between Mikio and his assailant was short and brutal. The intruder was armed with a traditional Japanese kitchen knife, which he used to repeatedly stab the father of two in the head, so hard that the end of the blade broke off, lodging itself deep inside the victim's skull. Before he died, Mikio had successfully managed to inflict some minor injuries on his attacker, but he simply could not survive the strength and brutality of the onslaught he had faced. As his lifeless body fell backwards down the stairs into a heap, the killer then followed it down to the first floor landing, where he repeatedly hacked and slashed at it with the broken knife. After concluding this senseless desecration, he then turned and walked back up to the second floor. Here, he attacked Yasuko and her daughter, inflicting injuries far more savage than those he had inflicted upon the male members of the household, before finally ending their lives using a Sanko knife from the Miyazawa kitchen. His goal now seemingly complete, the murderer unplugged the phone line, but then elected not to make good his escape. Instead, for the next few hours, he chose to remain inside the house, carrying out a series of seemingly mundane tasks. Ignoring the bloodied and battered bodies of his four victims, he had located the family's first aid kit and then treated his injuries. But he made no effort to clean up the blood he had lost, or to hide or conceal the dressings he had used. He simply left them lying on the floor in plain sight for the authorities to find. Having cleaned and bandaged his minor cuts, the killer then moved into the family's kitchen, where he made himself a pot of barley tea. To go with his drink, he removed and ate some melon slices from the fridge, before going on to consume 4 ice creams from the freezer. After this, it seems the attacker went for a nap on one of the living room sofas for an hour or two. He then awoke and logged onto Mikio's computer for a time, before using one of the toilets and making no effort to flush away the waste he had left behind, and then finally exited the address in the early hours on New Year's Eve. The police were quick to discover that the family's killer had left the broken murder weapon at the scene, which bore traces of both his blood and that of his victims. He had also inexplicably left a small bag lying on the floor, which contained highlighter pens and a small quantity of sand. All of these items were duly recovered and sent for forensic analysis, in the hope of identifying the killer. And whilst, along with clothing fibres which were also discovered, they did provide vital clues as to the identity of the murderer, it quickly became clear that the hunt for him would not be an easy one. The killer's DNA and fingerprints were both identified and analysed, but did not match anything held within any of Japan's national databases. What could be ascertained from the analysis is that he was male and of mixed heritage, with one parent likely to have come from southern Europe or the Mediterranean region. His blood was identified as type A, and from the nature of the wounds he had caused to his victims, he was believed to be right-handed, of a slim build, and measuring roughly 170 centimeters tall. Analysis of the force used to commit the murders produced an age range of between 15 and 35 years old, but beyond that, nothing more of a conclusive nature could be confirmed. Analysis of the fecal matter, which had so carelessly been left behind in the toilet at the crime scene, indicated that at some point during the day, before he had committed the murders, the murderer had consumed a simple meal of string beans and sesame seeds. It would later be confirmed that both the kitchen knife used to commit the murders and the clothing that the killer had worn had been purchased somewhere in Japan's Kanagawa Prefecture, situated over an hour's drive away. In time, the police were able to confirm that only 130 units of the sweater worn by the murderer had been made and sold, but frustratingly, their inquiries would only lead them to 12 consumers who had purchased these garments. However, perhaps the most surprising and intriguing clue as to the attacker's identity would come from detailed analysis of the sand, which had been found inside the discarded bag. Scientists were able to narrow the source of this particulate down to the Nevada desert in California. More specifically, the area situated around the Edwards Air Force Base. Since the time of the murders, there have been a number of different hypotheses put forward regarding who could be responsible for the senseless killing of this young and seemingly unassuming family. These vary somewhat in terms of their viability and credibility, and sadly, the nature of the evidence recovered by the police investigation appears so limited that no single suggestion seems to be any more realistic than the rest. Perhaps the most prevailing hypothesis suggests that the family fell victim to a stalker or sexual predator. The apparent discrepancy in the level of injury caused to the female members when compared to that of their male counterparts has led some psychologists to suggest that the killer likely possessed a pathological hatred of women. Others have suggested that the extreme violence that was used against the family as a whole is more indicative of a crime of passion. Potentially, this was a man who was completely obsessed with Yasuko Miyazawa, or conceivably an associate of the family who believed they had been wronged or dishonored by them at some point in the past. But investigations into known sexual predators and crimes which have occurred since the slayings, as well as inquiries with friends and extended family of the victims, have not produced anything to escalate either of these theories beyond mere speculation. If the Miyazawa family were perhaps guilty of some past misdemeanor, then it has yet to be uncovered. Looking outside of the family and its history, another popular theory is that the killer may have been a migrant or drifter. The location, like many other houses in Japan, was located a short walk from a transportation hub, causing some to believe that the killer was traveling around the country via its extensive rail network. This chilling hypothesis is worryingly similar to that of the man from the train, which we have previously covered. It is believed by some that a man named Paul Mueller was responsible for a series of killings in the southwestern United States at the close of the 1800s, including the infamous Villisca Axe murders. He would allegedly travel by train through isolated rural areas in search of casual labor, before breaking into family homes and killing the occupants using their own tools. Since the 1980s, Japan has seen an influx of immigration from neighboring Asian countries. In addition, the country has also developed an issue surrounding drifters. The 1990s were a time of serious financial instability in Japan, with many workers becoming unemployed or experiencing severe losses. Some of these people have never fully recovered from this and have elected never to re-engage with the society that they feel so badly failed them. Rather than someone associated with the Miyazawa family, is it possible that their targeting was instead completely random? That their house was picked because it was the first one that the killer had encountered as he had left the adjoining park, or that he had seen them out shopping and decided to follow them home on an impulse? A similar theory involves the presence of the sand recovered from the bag left at the scene, which potentially links him to Edwards Air Force Base. This has led some commentators to assert that the murderer was one of the 50,000 US military personnel stationed in Japan at the time. Sadly, American servicemen and contractors have regularly been involved in high-profile crimes in the country, prompting national outrage and a demand for their removal. Were this to be the case, this theory would also comfortably explain the mixed DNA profile recovered from the killer. But perhaps the most reaching theories about the murders pertain to the open space situated behind the family home.
There have been suggestions that the Miyazawas had been offered up to 100 million yen to move, so that the authorities could demolish their house along with others in order to expand the park. There is also a rumor that in the weeks leading up to his death, Mikio had been involved in some form of altercation with a gang at the local skateboard park. Some believe that this may have led to either a biker or street gang murdering him and his family as a result of his disrespect. At the time of writing, the Tokyo Metropolitan Police are still believed to have a task force of 35 officers assigned to solving the mystery of the Miyazawa family murders. The investigation has secured over 12,500 different evidential exhibits, and there have been in excess of 15,000 tip-offs from members of the public to an information line set up by the police. After spending 8 long years heading up the case, Takeshi Tsuchida was eventually forced to retire, but has continued to pursue the matter independently from the ongoing police investigation. And after 20 years of the police conducting an annual service of remembrance at the crime scene, it has recently been announced that the building will now be torn down due to the structural damage that has naturally occurred through neglect and lack of maintenance. Although the Miyazawa family home will soon be lost, sufficient detail and evidence from inside it has been suitably preserved, in the hope that the man responsible for the crimes which took place there will one day be identified and brought to justice. Our hearts go out to the relatives of the Miyazawa family. May their loved ones rest in peace.
Not one suspect. See, look, I'm not going to make fun of this, but that's the way to do it, right? That's the way. If you want to kill somebody, that's what you got to do. One and done, kids. One and done. Or you're a drifter. Or you're, you know, I don't mean to sound morbid, but look, there are enough television programs on that if you want to get away with it, you can get away with it. But here's the problem, is that most serial killers have these little pesky common traits that most of us who, you know, aren't going to be serial killers don't have. So, for instance, Ted Bundy, the charmer, was encompassed a number of the traits, but one of the main traits was smooth talking but insincere. Ted Bundy was a charmer, the kind of guy that made it easy for people to be swept into his web. Quote, I liked him immediately, but people like Ted can fool you completely, end quote, said Anne Rule, author of the bestseller selling Stranger Beside Me, about her experiences with Bundy, a man she considered a friend. Another trait, being egocentric and grandiose. We talked about Jack the Ripper last week. He or she, but most likely he, thought the world of himself and felt he would outsmart police, so much so that he sent letters taunting the London officers. Quote, dear boss, he wrote, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. What's interesting is that no one has ever solved who, in fact, Jack the Ripper was. Lack of remorse or guilt. Joe Rifkin was filled with self-pity after he was convicted of killing and dismembering at least 9 women. He called his conviction a tragedy, but later in prison, he got into an argument with mass murderer Colin Ferguson over whose killing spree was more important. And when Ferguson taunted him for only killing women, Rifkin said, yeah, but I had more victims. See, that's the way to do it. You get a round table of serial killers who are still alive and have them just try to see whose penis is bigger when it comes to serial killing. Lack of empathy, I'm sorry, is another trait. Deceitful and manipulative. John Wayne Gacy refused to take responsibility for the 28 boys buried beneath his home, even though he also once said that clowns get away with murder. Quote, I think after 14 years under truth serum, had I committed the crime, I would have known it, end quote. So the man the neighbors all claimed to like, there's got to be something that would click in my mind. I've had photos of the 21 victims, and I've looked at them all over the years here, and I've never recognized any of them. Shallow emotions. German serial killer Rudolf Pleil, convicted of killing 10 people and took his own life in prison, compared his hobby of murder to playing cards and later told police, quote, what I did is not such a great harm with all these surplus women nowadays. Anyway, I had a good time. Impulsive Tommy Lynn Sells, who claimed responsibility for dozens of murders throughout the Midwest and South, saw a woman at a convenience store and followed her home, an impulse he was unable to control. He waited until the house went dark. Then, quote, I went into the house. I go to the first bedroom I see. I don't know whose room it is. End. I start stabbing, end quote. The victim, unfortunately, was the woman's young son. Poor behavior control is another trait. Dennis Nilsson, quote, I wish I could stop, but I could not. I had no other thrill or happiness, said UK killer Dennis Nilsson, who killed at least 12 young men via strangulation, then bathed and dressed their bodies before disposing of them, often by burning them. Need for excitement, Albert Fish, the masochistic killer with a side of sadism that included sending a letter to the mother of one of his victims describing in detail how he cut, cooked, and ate her daughter. Even the idea of his own death was one he found particularly thrilling. Quote, going to the electric chair will be the supreme thrill of my life, he said. Lack of responsibility. Back to John Wayne Gacy, quote, I see myself more as a victim rather than a perpetrator. In a rare moment of admitting to the murders, quote, I was cheated out of my childhood. I should never have been convicted of anything more serious than running a cemetery without a license. They were just a bunch of worthless little queers and punks, end quote. Early behavior problems are another trait of serial killers. Quote, when I was a boy, I never had a friend in the world, said German serial killer Heinrich Pomeranke, who began raping and murdering girls as a teen. Adult antisocial behavior. Gary Ridgway pleaded guilty to killing 48 women, mostly prostitutes, who were easy prey and were rarely reported missing, at least not immediately. Quote, I don't believe in man, God, nor devil. I hate the whole damned human race, including myself. I preyed upon the weak, the harmless, and the unsuspecting. This lesson I was taught by others, might makes right, end quote. And that's from the Book of Serial Killers, an encyclopedia of serial killers, 150 serial killer files of the world's most dangerous murderers by Jack Rosewood and Rebecca Lowe. So there you go, folks. 12 traits. If you might think you know somebody who might know somebody who may or may not be a serial killer. All right, folks, we're near the top of the hour break. Next hour, we will finish up our... we will conclude with possible answers as to what may be taking people within the often described Alaskan Triangle. We've covered mermaids. We've covered otter men. Tonight, we'll cover something perhaps a little more plausible. The ferocious Alaskan bear god, which may or may not be a possible reason as to why folks go missing under mysterious circumstances in the Alaskan Triangle. Do you know what the Alaskan Triangle is? It's like the Bermuda Triangle, but it's in Alaska. Now, mind you, it's a little tongue-in-cheek when we get into the program. It feels a bit scripted, but what else are you going to do? And then Thursday, I think probably we will dive back into Mr. Politis, but I can't guarantee that's going to happen because I can only last a few moments with Politis, and then I start losing my shit, as some people say. Which story is horrific, Pac-Woman? Oh, yeah, the traits of a serial killer. Yeah, they don't. There are some folks who are just hardwired differently. People ask me a lot of time, why do people commit crime? Hardwiring, yes, I understand. Environment and experience, right? Nature and nurture, I get it. But some MFers are just wired differently. Yes, thank you, Pat. My blood pressure, according to my last physical, is completely fine, except when I'm talking about Politis. Top of the hour music, folks, comes your way shortly. Get up, get a drink of something, and we will reconvene in 3 to 4 minutes. Thanks for listening.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
Lost a little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right, folks, welcome back to This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution.radio. Common spelling in your favorite browser gets you to our website. Top of the page, folks, when you arrive, from left to right, you'll see home schedule. Click on schedule. Studio A, Studio B. You will also read a nice box titled Open. If you feel as if you have the gift for gab, like most of us do, and you are, I don't know, let's say available around 3 to 4 a.m. Eastern time, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we've got an open slot for you on Studio B. Or perhaps you're available Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 6 a.m. Eastern time. Studio A, got an open slot for you. Perhaps you prefer the weekends. Early Saturday morning, 2 a.m. Eastern time, right after the open round table and right before after hours with Jer Bear, got an open slot on Studio A. Over on Studio B, maybe you're more of a early afternoon person. Saturday from 2 until 4 p.m. Eastern time on Studio B, got an open slot for you. So, gift for gab, head over to revolution.radio, click on the contact button. You will see two emails there, one for the Mad Painter and one for Lady Horse. Send both of those fine folks an email. Let them know who you are, that you're interested in having a conversation about possibly hosting a show. And they will get back to you right quick in a hurry. And while you're there, click on the store and donations tab. The store tab, you can pick up a coffee mug, weaponized mouse pad, a t-shirt. Our designer is Revolution's own, a Mad Painter. Right now, we have a 15% off sale. Or if you don't fancy any of the items, you can always make a donation. You can pay on a patron. There's a donor box tab. Direct payment through North America only. I'm sorry. If you're interested in providing some crypto, we've got some options there for you. Or if you just want to write a check and send it, bottom of the page, the old snail mail, you can send that off to Terry Ackerman. And the address is at the bottom of the donations page. So many, many, many things available for you at revolution.radio. Again, common spelling. And if at this moment, perhaps you're not in a position to donate, I get that. One way to support us, and it's completely 100% free. Go to revolution.radio. Join the chat room. 43 people in there this evening. Now, we've got some rules. Although I might drop the occasional, F-bomb here and there. I might use some colorful language. But always remember, first, we are a family. A family-based show, based station. So mind your P's and Q's or pints and quarts, if you know what I'm saying. And if not, Pat will kick your ass. So just know that. And don't be a pleb, all right? Don't be a pleb, because we've got seven admins 7 moderators. We've silenced 13 and we've blocked 1. So don't think that you are immune to. I'm sorry, Pat. Pat will kick your arse. Don't think you are immune to the swift kick in the arse in the one-way ticket to being blocked. I think the English, when they always say arse, because apparently, and they also end every word that ends in an A, it always has an R sound to it. So when I was in South Dakota, my English roommate always said South Dakota. And I maybe Suri one day can explain that to me, or if she's going to explain it on her program, she'll let me know why did the Europeans always end words and certain words with letters that are nowhere in the spelling at all. It's never made any sense to me whatsoever. Never made any sense to me whatsoever. But, you know, so is Orf. What is Orf? So is Orf. Arse and Orf? What is Orf? Is Orf a swear word that I don't know what Orf is. Is Orf a bad word? I don't know what Orf is. All right, folks. This week, our final installment of what's possibly causing the missing folks in the Alaskan Triangle. This week, we dive into the possibility that it's the ferocious Alaskan bear god. Look it up in the Urban Dictionary. All right, I'll do it right now. Orf. What does that mean? Norfolk International Airport. Oh, that's ORD. The Orf virus, sore mouth infection. Oh. Orf virus is a member of the Parapox virus genus in the pox virus family. This virus primarily causes an infection in sheep and goats. Although it can be transmitted to people, Orf virus infection in animals is commonly referred to as sore mouth, scabby mouth. Animals infected with Orf virus typically develop scabby sores, lesions around their lips, muzzle, and their mouth. I think that's also called herpes. I don't know. Okay, hold on. Urban Dictionary. I don't know what Orf means. Oh. Here it is. Oh! Oh. The new word of our generation, although a great word, it has been overused and has lost all meaning. Shut the Orf up, you orphan Orf face. Dude, I just Orfed my chick. Wow. So apparently Orf is a replacement for the F-bomb. I did not know that. What the Orf is going on? Listen here, you mother Orfer. It doesn't sound as good. All right, folks. Here we go. Just so you know, this is a dramatization based on eyewitness reports and legends. Viewer discretion is advised, or listener discretion is advised. There are roughly 740,000 people living in the great state of Alaska. In the past 20 years, more than 60,000 have been reported missing. Some believe a number of these cases stem from mysterious phenomena.
In 1957, a fisherman was coming in from a day on the ocean, hoping to outrun an approaching storm. As he cruised along Hinchinbrook Island, he saw a column of smoke and assumed it must be a village where he might find shelter. In 1950, the man went ashore to investigate. But instead of finding sanctuary, he found a mystery. The village was there with an active fire going, but there was no one to be found. It was as if everyone had vanished. Suddenly, he saw a massive bear-like beast, which sent him racing back toward his boat. Was the bear real or the embodiment of an Inuit legend, the Torngasuk, or bear god. While some view this being as a protector, lore suggests it will unleash its wrath when displeased. Since then, the area has had 7 more sightings of the beast, but no one from the town has ever been found. Inside the vast frontier of Alaska is a mysterious triangle, where each year, 5 out of every 1,000 people go missing.
Something out there.
3 investigators look for answers. Jax, a former police officer. Ken, a specialist in strange phenomena. And Tommy, an expert on Alaskan legends. Together, they uncover mysterious sightings and ancient legends, exploring the possibilities of those who go missing in Alaska. The team approaches Hinchinbrook Island in Prince William Sound, the abandoned town, believed to be a fishing village of about 70 people, was discovered near its southeast corner.
Guys, what I don't get, I mean, we've investigated a lot of cases where we've had individuals disappear. We're talking about an entire village of people. I mean, what would cause an entire village to just vanish?
It is really strange. I mean, for no bodies to be left there.
Yeah, there's no record of any type of natural disaster, like an earthquake or a tsunami or anything like that, volcano.
The fisherman claims he's looking around, you know, sees this large white bear.
You guys, we're talking about a village that presumably was pretty familiar and had lived with bears for a long time. You know, I think it's kind of a stretch to say that it's just, you know, a bear. If we're talking about a bear, we're talking about a bear that's big enough and bad enough and scary enough to cause an entire village to vanish. I mean, this sounds exactly like the Inuit legend of the Torngasuk, the bear god.
The Torngasuk legend describes a giant white bear that can act as either protector or accuser. As the master of whales and seals, it was often invoked by fishermen for a successful outing, and even by shamans for the curing of illness. But some say it would prey viciously on those who disrespected nature.
What if we're just dealing with some sort of exceptional bear, you know? There's a lot of explanations, guys, before we get into, you know, a god bear or a demon bear. We got a lot further to go on this one before we come up with any kind of answers. Maybe there was a singular bear with a genetic quirk that allowed it to grow really large. Evolution allows for that sort of anomaly.
One such anomaly has been found in cattle and other animals, a condition commonly known as double muscling. It's caused by a genetic mutation that inhibits the myostatin protein, which regulates muscle growth, resulting in larger, more powerful animals. If a bear had this condition, it might come across looking like a monster. The team arrives at the landing site where the fishermen pulled ashore 60 years ago. The reported location of the village is up in the woods. They remain vigilant. One sighting of this white bear was reported just 2 weeks ago by a hunter.
Pretty dense brush out here.
So could this white bear just be a polar bear? But this really makes sense down here.
Maybe it's not a pure polar bear. They have crossbred with grizzlies.
Polar bears are the largest bears in the world, which makes them the largest carnivores on land. Males commonly reach 1,500 pounds and can get well over 2,000. But in Alaska, their range is limited to the north and northwest fringes of the state. However, crossbreeds of polar bears and grizzlies have been found in the wild. Could this have led to a white bear that's comfortable in warmer climates?
Well, check this out, guys.
Oh, yeah, look at that. We still got some structure standing. It's been a long time. Look at all that growth, Tommy.
We gotta look for signs of bear here, any paw marks, tracks scratching the building.
I agree, we need to be looking for everything though, guys. I mean, we're gonna find out what happened to this village.
The abandoned village has shades of another American mystery. The the lost colony of Roanoke Island. Established in 1587, Roanoke was the first English colony in the New World. But when a supply ship showed up 3 years later, everyone had vanished. Theories ranged from an attack by hostile Spaniards to a failed relocation in search of resources. But these Alaskan natives were skilled survivalists and had no known enemies, limiting such theories.
Careful now, there could be squatters or wild animals that aren't happy to see us.
The village has been uninhabited for nearly 60 years, but relic hunters and other visitors have cleaned out most of it.
We're clear, Tommy. Coming out.
The team searches the sparse remains of the settlement. They know the odds of finding evidence this long after the incident are slim, but there could be traces of biological matter that offer some insight.
I pull out my UV light, hoping that I might get lucky and find some old dried blood or something, but I'm not seeing anything.
You guys seeing anything?
Not yet.
I'm just seeing a bunch of broken down buildings. There's a little creek back here.
This place is falling apart here.
We're clear here. Cam, we're good to go, buddy.
What's the plan?
Let's search all around it, look for everything, you know? I mean, any signs we can find at all, you know, bears, people, blood, and some sign of what happened in this village.
I think we need to check the perimeter of the village here.
I agree.
As the team widens their search, Ken breaks out a metal detector. If there are any shallow graves, there could be jewelry or other artifacts that might reveal them.
Leaving no stone unturned, huh?
Man, I'm finding nothing. The signs of remains, bones, anything. We pretty much can rule out plague and famine. I mean, we're so close to the coastline, all this lush landscape. There's no way people died of famine.
No.
And if it was a plague, if people died, there'd be remains.
Absolutely, you'd see something.
Hey, guys!
What do you got?
Just noticed something on the ground, so I started poking around over here. You seeing this?
Yeah.
I mean, look at these. These are definitely been placed here in a circle. This could mean something.
Ken has found a small ring of stones. It's unclear whether its function was ceremonial or survivalist.
I mean, it just kind of looks like a fire pit to me. You have potential squatters and maybe even residences here.
Can we just dig this up a little bit and see what's underneath?
All right,
we can do that.
What do you got there, Tommy?
It's been buried a long time.
Definitely looks like a vertebrae, doesn't it?
Yeah, those are bones.
For
sure. No doubt about it.
Looks like a fish to me.
I know from my research that stone circles have a lot of significance. The Inuit people would make sacrificial offerings to some of their spirits.
Well, I don't know if this is just a meal or part of an offering.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Sacrificial offerings are a part of virtually every known religion, grounded in the principle of bringing the best of one's bounty to the deity that provided it. But anything less could draw the god's wrath. Could these fish bones represent a sacrifice to the bear god Torngasuk, ruler of the sea? And could they be from the time when the village was still populated?
Fish is the offering of choice to the Torngasuk. So my theory may have some validity. Perhaps this bear spirit found this offering was not substantial enough, and so it, you know, drove the people out of this area.
Well, whatever happened, we need to bag it up and keep moving. Well, we're definitely not gonna know what it is until we get it analyzed, so let's get it to the lab and keep moving. My guess is that someone passing through here recently took a break and cooked the fish. Hopefully a forensics analysis can tell us for sure.
Let's see what else we can find.
As the day winds down with no more evidence found, the team heads back to the shore to meet up with the boat for a ride back to the mainland.
Well, I'm excited to find out what these bones are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, guys, we got some building material here.
Look at that. Tommy thinks that just drifted in, or it could be from the village.
Oh, I think it absolutely drifted in. It's all rounded. It's been on the beach for a long time. Could have been a cabin or part of a dock.
A barnacle or something.
Yeah, buried in there, Tommy.
A rock.
Hey, Ken, check that out.
Hey there.
What is this?
That's not driftwood.
What do you think could have done that?
What's that from?
It's old. Some of the planking on a boat.
Let me see that. That could be interpreted as teeth marks, right?
I see what you're looking at.
Tommy, what do you think?
I don't know.
All right, well, if that is a bite, then what could possibly make a bite that large?
Nothing that I know of. Maybe it's not a bite mark. The idea of an animal attacking a boat doesn't make sense. Most animals will swim away before risking that kind of confrontation. But I have to admit that missing chunk does look a lot like a bite mark. I know it's bigger than a sea lion can do.
How about a shark? Salmon shark?
Salmon shark's not gonna bite through this thick of plank.
I mean, guys, this opens up a whole nother mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not qualified to make a determination as to what this is, so I think we need to get this in the hands of an expert.
The interior of Alaska has vast stretches unexplored by modern man. What unknown creatures might be lurking in this enormous expanse? And could they be contributing to the large number of people that go missing here? A northern legend of a massive bear god called Torngasuk seems to be based on a real animal, the polar bear. But polar bears don't exist in the southern part of the state, where a sighting tied this legend to a vanished village. One possibility is that the witness saw a Kermode bear, a black bear with a recessive gene that turns 10% of its population white. This has earned it the nickname Spirit Bear. The problem is, Kermode bears are a small species, too small to match the testimony, and far too small to drive away an entire village of natives. The team found some fish bones at the site and a strangely damaged board that they hope will shed light on the mystery. Ken and Tommy visit the zoo to meet with Tim Bertram, an animal expert who's examined their evidence.
Come on in.
Hey, Tim.
Hey.
It's my friend Tommy.
Hey, man. Tommy, nice to meet you.
Hi.
What do we got?
I got your results in, and what we have here is a large flatfish. So I did have them run some tests, and the DNA sample came back that it is a halibut.
Well, can you tell us anything about the age?
Unfortunately, carbon dating of bones of this nature has a wide margin of error. You couldn't really tell the difference between a 10-year-old bone and a 50-year-old bone. My best guess is it's been weathered and buried for a few decades.
Yeah. Halibut has always been a prized food fish in southern Alaska. So there's a good chance it was just somebody's meal. Without knowing the age of the bone, we can't assume that it was any sort of offering.
So, Tim, what about the board we found? I mean, those look like bite marks. Is there any chance that those could have been made by some kind of sea creature or maybe even a bear?
It's interesting because they do look like bite marks, and they do look like they're puncture wounds from the canine teeth of a large carnivore. The combination of canines and incisors makes it likely that it would be from a mammal and not from a fish. It could be sea lions. They have very similar dentition to the bears. Wolves also have similar dentition. However, what really strikes me is the distance between the two canines. The canine teeth on an adult polar bear are on average about 3 inches apart.
Hmm.
Your board actually has a gap of 5 inches.
That's a little less than double the size. Could this bear be twice the size of normal?
Well, if you multiply the distance across the canine teeth and extrapolate that, that would indicate a bear that was perhaps 8 times the normal size of adult bears today in Alaska.
The size difference of the bite mark is only across one dimension, width. If the difference were multiplied across all 3 dimensions, it would suggest a bear of unbelievable proportions.
Well, that's biologically impossible, right, Tim? I mean,
the bear would collapse
onto itself.
Right.
I would agree. This could be an anomaly. It could perhaps be a bear with a disfigured jaw or something of that nature, or it could be from a completely different animal. There are extinct bears that do have larger sizes than today's bears. The short-faced bear is an example of a Pleistocene bear that grew to extreme sizes, larger than today's biggest polar bears and biggest Kodiak bears. It also had a different dentition than those bears. It had shorter jaws, and they were very powerful, very muscular.
The giant short-faced bear was a colossal specimen that once roamed the Alaskan wilderness. This enormous animal could stand 12 feet tall, and its larger legs enabled it to run at speeds up to 40 miles per hour. Its short, compressed muzzle gave it a wider spread of teeth, similar to the mark on the wood. But all signs are that this bear went extinct about 20,000 years ago. Could there be a surviving strain living in the wilds of Alaska?
Was there any DNA on the sample? Or?
No, we weren't able to get any DNA off that sample.
Okay.
Well, Tim, this has been great information. Thanks again for your time. I always appreciate it.
On a quest to find a more modern incident that might tie into the Bear God legend, Jax heads to a local dock. He's been told that one of the captains knows all the stories that have taken place in the nearby waters.
Hey, Captain Mike.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Hey, I'm Jax.
Oh, good.
Nice to meet you.
Oh, pleasure to meet you.
Hey, I won't take a whole lot of your time. I just got a little interesting question to ask you. My friends and I, we were out on Hitchbrook Island, and we found a piece of shipwrecked wood that has got what appears to be a bite mark out of it. Have you ever heard of any strange encounters near Hinchinbrook involving animal attacks?
I do know a guy that, oh, 7 or 8 years ago had a bad experience out in the Sound. He was out fishing in that same area around Hinchinbrook. And something hit the boat. And he sees this massive white paw just grabbing the boat. And tried to get away real quick, but by the time you look again, there's just a little swish in the water where something was there.
When you say paw, you're referring to a bear paw, right?
Well, he didn't know what it was, but he described it like a bear paw.
And that was all he saw?
That's all he saw.
So something that'd be pretty big to
It'd have to be pretty substantial. Yeah. Huh.
So did you believe the guy?
Well, I don't know him that well, but he seems like a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
And just from the look and the terror on his face when he told me the story,
all right,
I believe he saw something.
Well, you think he'd show me on a map where it was?
Yeah, you bet. He said it's right outside the Cordova Harbor here.
Okay. And what was our distance from the harbor?
Well, from the north end of Hinchinbrook, it's right at 25 miles.
I don't know if that fisherman actually saw a bear, but bears are territorial, and it's happened in the same basic territory as the village. So maybe there's something to this.
Each year in the Alaska Triangle, thousands of people are reported missing. In most cases, it's one or two people at a time who disappear into this vast wilderness. But what could have caused an entire village to vanish? Sightings of a large white bear have called to mind the Torngasuk, a bear god of northern folklore. Could this metaphysical being be active down here? Or is there a more tangible animal on the prowl? The team starts prepping for an overnight stakeout. While Tommy secures a bear trap, Jax and Ken meet with some bear survival experts.
This is the place, man.
Just in case there's a real bear out there.
Hey, guys.
Hey,
how you doing?
How you doing, man?
How's it going,
I'm Jax.
Ken?
Yeah,
Brian
Clint,
man.
Nice to meet you, Clint.
So what are you guys doing here in Alaska?
Well, we're on an investigation that we think possibly might be dealing with an exceptionally large bear.
So do you guys want to capture or kill this animal?
Capture it, first off, so we can continue our investigation. But the whole idea is to not die. So
that's the most important one, for sure.
So I guess the question I would ask you guys, what is your experience with firearms?
We're going to be using a tranquilizer gun out there. But I always carry a sidearm.
When we meet people with firearms, we try to shy away from depending on ballistics. Let's go over here. one point we want to make about using the firearm. Clint, can I have one of those to work with right there, okay? When an individual is in this position and they're defending themselves from a bear attack, if they miss the bear, they're in almost one of the worst positions for an attack. And the person now goes back on their back, and this is now all open to attack. Mm-hmm. That's why we like spray, because it's an all-encompassing wall of pepper and, you know, and a deterrence. Do you want us to show you some bear spray?
Absolutely.
That would be awesome.
We got a lot of bear spray here at the school.
I am confident in my shooting abilities, but I know short-range handgun shots can miss or be ineffective, so it's good to practice another option.
First things first, grab both hands, go ahead and aim at your target, and you want to have it high, your hands a little bit higher, right about there, good. And then what I want you to do is simply take your thumb, put it forward, and pull that safety off. There you go, excellent. Now this is, your safety is off and you're ready to fire. Your thumb is gonna go right on this black lever, and let's go ahead and see what that feels like. And go.
Keep spraying.
Bring it down slightly, bring it down.
Yeah, there you go, good.
Keep going, Ken.
Keep going, dump that thing.
And turn.
Good job, excellent.
That's how it goes.
Safety's back on.
Yeah.
Using this bear spray seems easy, but if there's an 800-pound bear coming at me, that's gonna be some pressure. I can see how you could struggle with the safety or miss the trigger. And if this bear is multiple times normal size, then even a perfect shot might not stop it completely.
The possibility of a monstrous bear is more than a theory to Paul Vardell, who had a strange experience near Cordova in 2010.
So I was doing this Saturday hike near the coast, and the path is kind of up in the woods, and it gets a pretty decent breeze in the summertime. As I was hiking along, I smell this, like, briny ocean smell, which would have made sense closer to the water, but this far up, it seemed off to me. I didn't think much of it. I kept hiking. I come around this corner in the trail, and up ahead there's this rock outcropping, and just over the outcropping I can see the back of what has to be this just huge animal. And the first thing that came to my mind was polar bear, because it was white, which makes no sense. There's no way a polar bear would be this far south, and even a polar bear is not gonna be that big. And before I really registered what I was seeing, I hear this low, deep, like, rumbling growl, and whatever it was dropped down below the rocks. I just froze, and I sat there for like 2 or 3 full minutes. Eventually, I convinced myself to kind of walk up around and see if I could see what this thing was, and by the time I got up around the rocks, it was gone. There was nothing there. But in the ground, there were these huge paw prints, like 2 or 3 times the size of a normal bear paw print. I didn't stick around to find out what it was. I got out of there, because anything that big would eat me whole.
Armed as well as they can be, the team heads back toward Hinchinbrook Island to do an overnight stakeout. They brought bait to go with the trap Tommy's procured. It'll be set up as an offering to the bear god, while also serving as a lure for any real bears.
Well, we're gonna set the trap up near a tree, because we have to have an anchor to attach it to so it doesn't get away. Extreme caution out there, because, you know, you step into that trap, it'll snap your leg right off. It's got teeth on it.
All right, well, sounds like we got all the bases covered.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of anything else.
Hey, guys.
What's up?
You got your binoculars? Look at that tree cropping right there.
Where? There?
Yeah, that cropping of trees right there. That's something very large and white.
I don't see anything.
I don't know if the story's getting to me, but I'm convinced I saw some sort of big white creature out there in the woods. We have to get there immediately. Hey, guys.
What's up?
Look at that tree cropping right there. Something very large and white. Whatever it is in the trees now. I don't know if the story's getting to me, but I'm convinced I saw some sort of big white creature out there in the woods. We have to get there immediately.
The team makes their way toward the tree line, They know it's only been 2 weeks since a hunter reported seeing a huge white bear here, so they have to be cautious.
Hey guys, I think I last saw it up this way. Guys, I saw it right in this area.
What's that? Hold on, Tom.
Oh, yeah.
See the trail?
Huh. Think that's a bear track? I'm vaguely seeing some toes up there. This is more of a heel pad back here. I don't think it's a brown bear, because you definitely would see claw marks up there.
This track is smeared. I know that the pads of polar bear feet contain lots of tiny papillae. They help to create friction between the foot and the ice. Obviously, the track is too compromised to see if it had those.
Polar bears have smaller, stubbier claws, more pulled back.
Considering how fast this thing, whatever it was, disappeared, completely vanished, I don't think we can rule out something supernatural here.
Well, guys, I believe I saw something here, so I think I need to set up a stakeout. Let's find a good spot for me to be in this area.
Yeah.
Splitting up for the night will maximize our chances for seeing what's out here. It sounds risky, but we've had our bear defense training, so it's worth the gamble. Up here, guys, there's a clearing up here. Yeah, I think this is a good spot, guys.
Great vantage point, man.
I got a good vantage right here. Yeah. I can stay in contact with you guys with the radio, and you guys can head up to the village.
Sounds good. Yeah. Sounds good.
All right. We'll check in a few minutes.
The team leaves enough gear for Jax to set up an overnight stakeout in the woods. He pitches a tent and will log his time here on a video camera. Ken and Tommy arrive at the village and set up the bear trap at the stone circle, which they can watch from nearby structures.
What are we doing here, Tommy? What's this for?
Making a little tripod to hold the bait. That's rockfish.
Tommy places a camera next to the bait.
Looks like it's set, Ken. Let's go to the cabin, huh?
It will provide a live feed to their laptop, allowing them to get an up-close look at anything that approaches the trap.
Preparing for this stakeout is unnerving. I mean, if there's an oversized bear out there, I've got to wonder if a tranquilizer gun and bear spray are going to be enough. And if it's a bear god, we might suffer the same fate as the former residents of this village.
The possibility of a massive bear on Hinchinbrook Island is not unprecedented. The test case is just down the Gulf of Alaska on Kodiak Island, home of the largest brown bears in the world. Kodiak bears were cut off from the rest of their species during the last ice age 12,000 years ago. Oftentimes, an isolated population of large carnivores evolved smaller due to limited resources. But the abundance of salmon on Kodiak, coupled with the lack of competition, had the opposite effect. Could a similar situation on Hinchinbrook have caused the same result for a population of white bears? Longtime Alaskan resident and pilot Noah Silver believes so, based on something he saw while flying over Hinchinbrook in 2004.
I've lived in Alaska my whole life, and I fly my plane to get around. One night I was flying through some dense fog and decided I needed to get down so that I could not just rely on instrument navigation. As I pulled into the clear along the shoreline, I noticed a huge creature, a giant really. It looked like a polar bear, except for 3 or 4 times as big, maybe 10 feet or more at the shoulder. I turned around to get a better look, but by the time I doubled back, it was gone. I once heard of a legend of a giant bear, and to me now it's not a legend, it's real.
Several hours into the stakeout, the team has yet to see or hear anything unusual. Jax scans the surrounding woods with a thermal imager, looking for any heat traces that indicate a life form.
No signs of scat or broken branches. The foliage is very dense. I think if there was a large bear here, there'd be a lot more broken branches.
Ken, you see anything?
Nothing yet, brother.
Nothing.
grab the thermal camera and have a look outside here. Keep an eye on her trap out there.
Good idea.
It's a little surprising to me that we haven't seen anything so far. That fish is a tempting food source. I mean, I would think that something would have at least checked it out.
All right, it's 0247 hours. I've completed my thermal imaging around the camp. I've seen no signs of bear or any knockdown branches or signs of scat. Temperatures have really dropped, and it's raining. I'm trying to warm up here in the tent for a little bit. Hey, Tommy.
Yeah, Jax.
Real cold and real quiet. How about you guys?
Yeah, same here. We're not reading anything.
All right, we might be in for a long one.
Long one, yes indeed.
What was that?
You heard that?
I heard that.
I think it came from the direction of Jax's camp.
Here, I'll give him a shout.
No. Don't call him. You could potentially bring something to him, you know what I mean? If they hear the walking go off.
Gotcha.
Should we go down there?
We should.
Get the rifle.
Yeah, I got the rifle.
Lights on.
If the team is hearing a bear, it's a frightening concern. Bears prefer to steer clear of humans. If it's coming close, it could be on the hunt and viewing them as prey.
Jax!
Shh.
What do you got, man?
I don't know. Definitely like a low guttural growl sound. I couldn't tell what direction it came from.
It sounded like it was coming from your direction. That's why we come over.
I've done a couple 360 sweeps all the way through camp, but I didn't see anything. I know I heard something, but there hasn't been a sound since I got outside the tent. If an animal were still around, the thermal would have picked it up. Whatever made that noise, it must have been heading somewhere else. I think we need to get back to your guys' trap.
Let's get up and see what's happening there. Well, trap's still there, bait's there. Trail cam.
Yep, trail cam's clean. No pictures.
Everything's undisturbed.
This is really disappointing. The night's nearly over and we have nothing to show for our stakeout. We need to regroup and see if there's any final play we can make in the time that we have left.
You guys want to head back to your cabin?
Well, if there was a bear in the area, it would have definitely gone for that fish.
Sure enough, you know they're smelling it.
Well, unless it was smart and knew it was a trap.
So you're acknowledging that we could be dealing with something supernatural, that maybe the Tungusuk could be a real thing?
At this point, I don't know what to believe. What the crap, guys? What happened? You guys all over the place.
We did not leave it like this, man. This has obviously been ransacked.
Man, I am convinced someone is on this island messing with us. Start accounting for our gear, man. There's a lot of expensive stuff here.
Here's my night vision.
Computer.
Computer's still there.
Our bag was just totally ripped wide open.
Flipped over. I've got K2, I've got GPS, call blaster.
All the food's gone.
All right, well, bears are notorious food thieves, right?
So are humans.
But if we're humans, you know, look at all our expensive equipment's here.
And it's pretty damp out there, man. There'd be like footprints or something.
Whatever came in here didn't leave us any identifying evidence. So could this have been some kind of metaphysical being, maybe sending us a message? You know, guys, think about it. Maybe this was the Torn Gasuk. I mean, maybe this is some kind of warning. By taking our food, it's trying to tell us what? Get out of here, you have no more food, you can't survive, something like that?
All right.
I don't feel safe. I'm gonna pack up my gear. Whatever's in here obviously knows we're here.
I don't see any evidence of who came in here.
The team decides to collect their gear so they can spend the rest of the stakeout at Jax's tent. They'll be safer as a group if anyone or anything comes looking for more contraband.
Let's get rolling. Wait a minute. Hey, Ken, check this out. Look at that, Jax.
What is that? What's that white, fuzzy stuff up there?
That's hair.
The Alaska Triangle is known for the large number of people who go missing here. But what could make the population of an entire village vanish? Could the Torn Gasuk, a god in the form of a giant white bear, have driven the villagers away or destroyed them completely? The team was hoping to find evidence of this legendary figure or of any real bear that could have inspired it.
Let's get rolling.
And they just found an intriguing clue.
Wait a minute. Hey, Ken, check this out. Look at that, Jax.
What is that? What's that white, fuzzy stuff up there?
That's hair. Or fur or something, man.
Is it like cotton or wood?
Okay, well, what are we looking at in terms of indigenous animals here?
Tall sheep. That's way too tall for that.
Mountain goat.
Same thing. It's way too up there, way too high.
Maybe this is your polar bear here, Jax.
We haven't found any biological evidence at all, so this is kind of exciting.
The lab can check this out for us. Tommy, you got that paper bag? I don't know if this hair is connected to whatever stole our food, but it is tangible evidence of something that was in the structure once, and we need to find out what it is. I can't identify that.
Tommy, you've worked with polar bear fur. Does that look anything like it?
No. Polar bear fur is a lot coarser, thicker, and translucent. This is not translucent at all.
It's a common misperception that polar bear fur is white. Each hair is actually colorless, with a hollow core that reflects and scatters light in a way that creates the illusion of whiteness. The same phenomenon is at play with snow. Each flake is composed of ice crystals, which are translucent. But in aggregate, they appear white. What that means is, if this hair is from a bear, it's not a typical polar bear.
Well, we got a whole bunch of it, whatever it is.
Well, let's get that off to be analyzed.
The team heads for Jax's tent to finish their stakeout. But the rest of the night remains uneventful. Two days later, they reconvene in town to discuss the results of the lab test.
Hey, gentlemen, how we doing?
Good. All right. Well, I got something for you. I was honestly kind of nervous because, as you know, with hair samples, it's kind of hit and miss. But it turns out that the hair is human.
Human?
Yeah. Now, the sample is highly degraded. It's decades old.
Huh.
I think the likely reality is that the hair belonged to someone who lived in the village, you know, before everyone vanished.
That old, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. So
kind of makes sense, though.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they're thinking. Now, obviously, it didn't match anybody in their database, so.
Of course not from a sample that old. I wouldn't expect someone from a fishing village to be inside any DNA website.
Well, this proves that this hair doesn't belong to a polar bear. But we have other clues we still can't explain.
Yeah, I mean, if you consider the smeared footprint that we found and that enormous bite out of the board, that suggests a bear with a deformed jaw or a bear of potentially extraordinary size. It kind of fits the mold of the Torn Gasuk. You know, consider a spirit a spirit who can temper his wrath. And, you know, essentially he was giving us a warning. He was a protector. Mm-hmm. So rather than attacking us, he was, you know, basically just telling us to get out of there, so.
So which is it? An exceptional bear, or like you're saying, maybe a bear spirit?
The team is unable to prove the existence of a physical being that would explain these bizarre bear sightings. Could such a creature exist? Genetic differentiation does show that white bears can be found in non-polar regions, but would a purely physical bear, no matter how large, be enough to frighten off an entire native community? Sightings indicate something is behind the Torngasuk legend. Whether it's an animal or a god, its existence could be one more reason.
Hey, wait a minute. Hey, Ken, check this out.
People continue to go missing in Alaska.
Man, you know, look, I don't mean to be that guy, but I've seen better acting in fourth grade plays. I'm just saying. What did I miss here in the chat room? I was looking at something. Go woke up or something. Oh, are you woke? Yes, I just woke up. I'm happy. I'm refreshed. I'm just being that guy. Oh, Pat, also, just so you know, sir, I forgot to mention this, but you had sent me a story about Noah Donahoe. That I'll be going over on Thursday. Young lad missing since 2020. So that's compliments of Pat Cornelius Rabbit III for sending me that story over El Skypo. Over El Skypo. Have I missed anything? I don't think I've... No, we've covered a lot. We've covered Chicago crime. We've covered some national park stuff. We've covered some missing people. We've covered Smiley Face a little bit. We've finally maybe found the answer to... Well, no, we haven't. We haven't found any answers in the Alaskan Triangle. What's going on? We are 0 for 5. There is no evidence of the ferocious Alaskan polar god bear. So... You know, who knows? I'm still betting it's the large crevasses and it's the fact that there's a crap ton of square miles that are uninhabited and people just wander off into no man's land. I think what's funny about this thing, if you weren't seeing the video, but when they went back and saw their cabin, and they go, oh my gosh, it's ransacked. I mean, again, I've heard and seen better acting in fourth grade plays than what we all auditorially witnessed here. It could be White Bigfoot. It could be. Could be White Bigfoot. Could be a lot of things. Could be Pat. Pat could be broadcasting live from Alaska and just kidnapping people. Alaska is a bit like Iowa. I mean, you can hide a body and nobody will find it. There are people that literally think I'm slightly obsessed or I'm going to kill somebody because it's intriguing to me that when people go missing, they act as if it's some mysterious event. And look, I'm not saying that people who go missing, some missing individuals are shrouded in mystery. Case in point, Jody Huzentut from Iowa has been missing for 20 plus years. Rumors has it that she was friendly. I'm not quite sure if there's a relationship with an older man in the neighborhood who was always a person of interest. I think he's since moved from the area. But, you know, she went missing sometime around 3:30 in the morning on her way to work. I believe they found one of her red shoes and the keys still in the door lock of the car. Never to be seen again. I don't know if Jody Huizintoot is a 411. Actually, I should email Polite and say, you should really look into this story. Into this story. Because that she was pronounced dead a number of years ago. But yeah, she's been missing for quite a long time. I think maybe I will, I think on Thursday I will update the folks. Just a quick refresher on the Jody Huizintoot situation. So let me make sure I put that in my in the show notes for the 15th, this Thursday. All right, folks, that is the end of the program this evening. Thank you for listening. Have yourself a fabulous Monday. Again, we'll do this again on Thursday. Same bat time, same bat channel. Not quite sure if that's copyrighted. If it is, I owe somebody some money. Thanks for listening. Head over to revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite browser. And in the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mystery.